Huh? You're not. Well, maybe you'll learn something new then.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you might come from Palestine and you might have a guest speaker today or something. Good morning, Christy. How are you? I love you too. Praise the Lord. Okay, let's continue our discussion on grief today. And that's what we primarily talked about, of course, yesterday is Greece and the Grecian Empire. There are a couple things that we didn't have time to talk about, though, and I'm going to spend only a few more minutes talking about this today. But we mentioned basically at the close of the hour that there were four Grecian generals who took over the kingdom of Alexander, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus, and they began vying with each other for power and control of the ancient empire of Greece. And eventually what happened is they weakened themselves, which opened the door for Rome then to begin to conquer them. And Rome began to systematically do that, and of course began with the region closest to them, the area of Macedonia and Italy itself. And so that area was the first to fall, and eventually, within, oh, I suppose about maybe 100 years, the Romans had conquered pretty much the entire remaining Grecian Empire. Now, I'd like to spend a few minutes today talking about the abiding influence of Greece. The abiding influence of Greece. How there was an influence that remained even after Greece was conquered. And of course, like I mentioned, even many English words are of Grecian origin, and there are facets of our culture today that actually are remnants that have remained with us from the Grecian Empire. We've got the Olympics, our form of government, democracy, is modeled to a certain extent after what happened in Greece, early Greece, and also the early Roman Empire, and other facets as well. Of course, the philosophy is real rampant. You could go to any university, and there's a lot of Grecian philosophy right there for you. The abiding influence is a very significant thing in studying Palestine, because within a period of about 200 years or so, after Alexander the Great had conquered Palestine, his Hellenistic culture surrounded and penetrated the very land of Palestine itself. And in fact, there was even a Hellenistic party amongst the Jewish priestly aristocrats. The ruling priests of the land of Palestine even were very Greek-oriented. And in fact, at one point in time, the very Old Testament religion was threatened and so forth. It was so influential. But Greek culture and philosophy was widespread at Field, Palestine. The Greek language became the universal language of Palestine. So much so that during the time of Jesus, when everyone was born, that was their primary language, was the Greek language. Even though the Romans had conquered the world, and even though the Romans were the ruling power, and even though the Romans spoke Latin, still, Greek was the language of Palestine. It was on the coins from the merchants, Greek words, Greek names. It was on the roadside inscriptions as you walk down the streets and the roads of Palestine. There were Greek signs with Greek inscriptions on them. The Aramaic language became full of Greek words. Greek became the universal written language, so that the children that were raised in Palestine learned how to write in Greek. And that's what, of course, Peter wrote in, and that's what John wrote in. They were fishermen, but they wrote their epistles in Greek. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, all the others basically wrote in Greek. Matthew, of course, author of the Gospel of Matthew, would have known Greek very well in his position as a Roman tax collector. Philip and Andrew, two other disciples of Jesus, those are Greek names. Those are not Jewish names. Philip and Andrew, those are very clearly Greek names. Almost every Jew was bilingual. Almost every Jew spoke Greek and the Aramaic language as well. They'd speak like Aramaic in the synagogues and to their friends and family members. And then also as a secondary language, and actually almost as a primary language, really, they also spoke Greek. And really, that was a real blessing and a real boon in disguise for Christianity, because what happened is when Christianity came into the world and Jesus died, there was now a vehicle for expressing the gospel worldwide. The Greek language was such that you could go anywhere and preach the gospel all throughout the Roman Empire. And many of the other cultures, they spoke a different language, but more often than not, they were bilingual and also understood Greek as well. And it's a very beautiful language. It's flexible. It's expressive. and also capable of taking on new dimensions in the meaning of its words, and so God chose the Greek language to write the New Testament in. Well, let's spend a few minutes talking about what is called the intertestamental period of history. The intertestamental period of history. Now, very simply, that is the period of time between the Old and the New Testament. 400 years occur between Malachi and the book of Matthew. That's called the intertestamental period of time. And that period has also been called the 400 years of silence, from Malachi all the way up to Matthew. Now, that's a long time not to hear from heaven. And that's what happened to Israel. There were no prophets for 400 years. Malachi was the last voice of prophecy, and the voice of prophecy was silent all the way from Malachi to John the Baptist. And John the Baptist was the real first real prophet to be heard in the land again. Now, this period is not silent in the sense that there's no historical information about this time. There is a fair amount of information about it. And that's what we're going to spend a few minutes talking about. After Alexander's death, like we mentioned, the four generals took over his kingdom, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus, and they in turn began to try to conquer each other's empires. Well, there are two of them that play a very, very important part in the history of Palestine and of the Jewish people, and I'd like to write their names down on the board for you here again, namely Ptolemy the Ptolemies were reigning down in the land of Egypt, and then secondly, Seleucus. And they're reigning in the area of Syria. So Ptolemy, Ptolemy in Egypt, and then the Seleucids, Seleucid in Syria. So looking on our map right here, there are two major powers, Syria right up here. Seleucid controlled this area right up here. The Ptolemies controlled this area of Africa. Cleopatra, for example, was a Ptolemy ruler. And so they're fighting with each other, and guess who's right in the middle of it all? Palestine, the Jews. They're right smack dab in the middle of that whole warfare and all the conflict and everything. And so consequently, Palestine, alternatively, was under the control of the Ptolemies of Egypt and then also under the control of the Seleucids. They kind of bounced back and forth like a ping pong ball. It just went back and forth. The Ptolemies would reign, and the Ptolemies conquered the land of Palestine, and so the Ptolemies were reigning over Palestine, and then the Seleucids would come down and conquer the Ptolemies. And then Palestine would shift under the power and under the authority of the Seleucids. And it went back and forth like that, year after year after year. Well, whenever one dynasty ruled in Palestine, the Jews who favored the other regime migrated to its domain. In other words, there were Jews in Palestine that they favored the Seleucids, and other Jews favored the Ptolemies. So when the Ptolemies reigned, and when the Jews liked Seleucids, they'd move up north to Syria. And there was a great city that was started up here called the city of Antioch, up here north of Palestine. Maybe it's on this map right here. Oh, it's not off the map. We need to get another map here. That Antioch was up north in the area of Syria. And, of course, just the opposite happened as well. When the Seleucids conquered Palestine and there were Jews that favored the Ptolemies, they moved down south and they lived in a city called Alexandria. So it went back and forth like that. The city of Antioch is right up here. So many Jews migrated to Antioch, and then Alexandria is right here. So there were real large Jewish populations in both Antioch and in Alexandria, both of those two areas. But there's one period of time that I'd like to address real briefly. It's a rather complicated period of history. It's really outside the scope of this class to talk about in detail. But I'd like to talk about the period, or at least one period, of Seleucid control, in which the Seleucids were reigning from about 198 to 168 B.C. 198 to 168 B.C., about a 30-year period of time. It begins with a man whose name was Antiochus III. And there is another man that I'll write down on the board here for you in just a moment. But Antiochus III defeated the Egyptians and the Ptolemies and started a very time of horrible reigning over the Jews, and he had a successor whose name was Seleucus the Fourth. And Seleucus the Fourth tried to plunder the temple treasury but failed, and eventually he passes from the scene. And then there's another ruler, an infamous one, who comes to power, and his name is Antiochus the Fourth. And he's real significant in the history of the Jews. Antiochus the Fourth, and that's spelled A-N-T-I-O-C-H-U-S. He's also called Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. And this was kind of a nickname that he gave himself, Epiphanes. And that's spelled E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. Really what the word Epiphanes means is the manifest one. And it has the idea of manifest God. He felt like he was God. Or it means the illustrious one. That's the title to call yourself, huh? Walk around and say, the illustrious one, or the august one, or the manifest one, implying that he was the manifest God. Well, the point is that the man was very clearly deceived of the devil, Antiochus was, and he attempted to force the Greek games and the Greek culture upon the Jewish people. They did not want him ruling over them. Obviously, he was a wicked pagan, and he hated the Jews. He despised the Jews, despised them. And you can read about him in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 8, 9 through 12. Daniel chapter 8, 9 through 12. He did a number of horrible things, though. He came down, for example, and converted the Jewish temple into a shrine for the Greek god Zeus. And he took a pig and he boiled it in water and then sacrificed it on their altar and took the swine broth and the water and sprinkled it all over their temple just to upset them and to desecrate their temple. And he had a burning passion to unite all of his territory through the process of Hellenism, and massacred thousands of the Jews, slaughtered them, just like Adolf Hitler did. He was violently bitter against the Jews. He made a furious and determined effort to exterminate them. He felt like, this is what I want to do. I want to get rid of the Jews. And he tried to do that. He tried to exterminate them, tried to exterminate their religion. He prohibited temple worship. They could no longer worship in their temple. He forbade circumcision on the pain of death. Of course, to the Jewish mind, they could not participate in the covenant unless their young men were circumcised after the eighth day, and he forbade that. He sold thousands of Jewish families into slavery. He destroyed every copy of the Old Testament he could find throughout the land. He slaughtered anyone that was ever caught with a copy of the Old Testament. Obviously, the man was filled with the devil and was against the Jews. And you'll notice several times in history, the devil has raised up various people, filled them with the devil, to try to get rid of the Jews, like Adolf Hitler and Stalin and others as well have had a real hatred for the Jewish people. And the reason why the devil doesn't like the Jews is because they brought forth the Messiah, and God is going to restore them again in the millennium, and God still has his hand on them. And so he's tried to get rid of them. Well, this led to a period of time which is called the Maccabean Revolt. This is one of the real glowing periods of Jewish history, the Maccabean Revolt. Maybe you've heard about the Maccabeans, but the Maccabeans were actually Jews that were revolting against these Greeks reigning over them, the Seleucids. That's spelled M-A-C-C-A-B-E-A-N, the Maccabean Revolt. And that was a direct result of the policy of Antiochus Epiphanes. And there was a man, his name is really not significant, so you don't need to necessarily know the spelling of it, but his name was Matthias. And Matthias was a real devout Jew, real godly Jew. And he was upset with, of course, these wicked Greeks reigning over him. And so he killed an agent of the king Antiochus. This agent was sent to Matthias, and I'm not sure why the agent had been sent there. But at any rate, Matthias killed this agent and just killed him right there. And then he fled with his sons, and he had five sons, Judas Maccabeus, Simon Maccabeus, and three others. And they fled into the wilderness, and they organized a guerrilla army, a little small army, a little small band of Jews. And they were very patriotic, and they dedicated themselves to one cause, and that was liberating Palestine from the hand of Antiochus. Well, the odds were insurmountable against them. There's no way in the natural they could have ever overcome the Greeks, because the Greeks were very strong. The Greeks were military-minded. They had a large army, and the Greeks and the Jews had nothing. But at any rate, Judas Maccabeus organized this army, and started actually warring against the Greeks, making like plundering raids and foraging raids against the Greeks. And Antiochus obviously did not take them seriously. Seemed like they were just a little small, insignificant band of upset Jews. But Judas began to win victory after victory after victory. And furthermore, Antiochus's major forces were busy elsewhere, and so he sent very small detachments against Judas Maccabeus. And the word Maccabeus means the hammer. They called him Judas the Hammer, because that's the type of person he was. He was hammering against the Greeks. Well, Judas was warring against these Greeks, and victory after victory after victory after victory took place, and obviously God was with them. And the impossible took place, and Judas led his ill-equipped army to victory after victory until eventually he conquered Antiochus and conquered the Greeks. And all of a sudden, there was a time of Jewish independence, the first time in a long period of time. And it was rather short-lived because in just a few number of years, maybe, you know, I think it's only about maybe 100 years yonder, Romans are going to come down and conquer them. But there was a period of about 100 years in there in which there was a time of Jewish independence. Well, there was a real major feast that was instituted by Judas Maccabeus. And that was when he rededicated the temple in 165 B.C. It had been contaminated by Antiochus. So after Judas conquered the Greeks, he rededicated and he purified the temple and he reestablished all the Jewish rites of worship. I'm pretty sure that Judas was a priest before God. And this Jewish feast that commemorated the fact that the temple was cleansed is the one called Hanukkah. Maybe you've heard about that. The Feast of Lights. Hanukkah, and that became a prominent Jewish feast, and of course the Jews still celebrate it today. That is the devout ones, Hanukkah, and that's spelled H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H. It means the Feast of Lights, and there's a legend that says that when Judas Maccabeus was rededicating the temple, he went into the temple and he found a vial of oil. I believe this is how I've read it now. He found a vial of oil to light the menorah, the Jewish lamp inside the temple. And there was only enough for one day, only enough oil for one day. And he began to fill the menorah with the oil. And lo and behold, God provided enough oil for 8 days. And day after day, Maccabeus came back and filled the menorah with this oil, and it was shining for like 8 days. And it became a very, very famous feast, still commemorated today. And, of course, the whole thing culminated with the Jewish independence. And then there's one final name that I'd like to leave you with today, and that's the title Hasmoneans. The term Hasmoneans. And the period of Hasmonean rule. Hasmoneans, that's spelled H-A-S-M-O-N-E-A-N-S. Hasmoneans, these were the descendants of Judas Maccabeus. They were his descendants. And they were actually priests, and they became the rulers of Judah up until the time in which the Romans conquered them. So for maybe 100 years now, the Hasmoneans are ruling over the land of Judah. And that was a time of independence for them. And obviously God was not going to allow the Jews to be snuffed out. He had too much to do for them. Messiah had to come forth from them, and also God would never allow them to be stamped out. He's got all of his covenants and promises with Abraham and David and all the other men of God in the Old Testament. There'd be so many unachieved promises if he allowed them to be killed, and so God gave them that time of reprieve and independence. So that's kind of an interesting period. If you want to read more on this, you can read the books on history in the library. It's really a fascinating period because it's a time of real honor and real bravery on the part of the Jews. They were real courageous men that were warring against the Greeks. Are there any questions on what we've talked about with Greece? Yes. What year did he rededicate the temple? That was back in 165 B.C. 165 B.C. Yes, Debbie. What is that? Yeah, that's Hanukkah. Yeah, the Feast of Dedication. Yeah, that's the same as Hanukkah. And, of course, they just commemorated that year after year, even up to the present time. That's why, like, in a Jewish home, they'll start off and they'll burn, like, one candle, I think it is, the first night, and then the second candle. And I think they do that for, what, 7 or 8 nights like that. And you'll see a Jewish, sometimes they'll use Christmas lights or whatever in the front window, and they'll do it like that. Yes.
Back to Greece.
Yes.
You've heard of the gay group, the Dorian.
Yes.
How are they connected with the Lenoans, the Cam?
Well, I don't really know too much about that. He's alluding to the fact that there's a group called the Dorians, and they're homosexuals, avowed homosexuals. And the Dorians were one facet of early Greece that lived in the early Grecian Empire. And there was a philosophy amongst the Greeks that homosexual love was a pure love. It was even more pure than that between a male and a female that were married. That the highest form of love was between two males, homosexual love. And I would bet that they're probably taking it from that ancient Grecian philosophy, probably, i.e. from the pit, from the devil. Is there anyone else that, yes?
When you mentioned before that Matthias and his son,
yes,
they went off and they formed this army.
Yes.
And then you brought in Judas Maccabeus.
Right.
I missed the connection there between those.
Okay.
Two.
He was actually the son of Matthias.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Matthias, right. He was one of the five sons.
Oh, okay.
And he took over the leadership. And they called him Maccabeus. Was actually a nickname which meant hammer. They called him Judas the Hammer, and it was called the Maccabean Revolt. There's been a lot of Jewish legends and a lot of Jewish music and artwork generated around this whole event. Yes, someone else, I think. Yes, Carla.
When you were talking about the power play between the Hellenists and the Jews, and Jews went to Antioch.
Yes. Alexandria, down here. There was a major population down here in Alexandria, and this was right down here in the land of Egypt. So many went down there. The ones that favored the Ptolemies went to Alexandria. The ones that favored the Seleucids went up to Antioch. Normally speaking, the Seleucids were more wicked and more cruel in reigning over the Jews than the Ptolemies were. The Jews liked the Ptolemies a little bit better than they did the Seleucids. Okay, well, let's talk about a Bible custom then. Let's move on and talk about something else. And then we've got one more empire to talk about, and that'll be the Roman Empire. So we won't talk about that today. We'll talk about that next week. But let's talk briefly about foods and their preparation, and let's also talk about banquets and how they ate their foods and so forth. I don't know how they did it, but they survived without the golden arches. That, to me, is a miracle. I can't imagine living without the golden arches, but they did it. They survived. They made it somehow. Talking about life being hard, and it certainly was during that time. Actually, their meals really weren't that strange. They really didn't eat a lot of food that would be different than us today, but I'd like to go through and I'd like to list some of the prominent foods for you and just say a few things about them. There are a lot of scriptures that I can mention on these points, but I don't think that's really significant. You can look in almost any book on Bible customs, and they'll give you lots of scriptures on this. But it's pretty straightforward, really. Of course, one of the most obvious foods is grain, and grain was a real staple of their diet, if not the staple of their diet. It was very customary, very common in Palestine to eat raw grain, which is something that we don't eat too much over here. They would pick and actually harvest the grain before it had fully hardened. And there's a stage of development of the grain in which it's called the milk stage. And if you've ever gone out and looked at grain in the ear, it will be filled with this white milk-like substance. And that's when they would harvest it if they wanted to eat it raw. And they had several different ways of eating it. They might actually go out to the very fields and actually pluck the grain right from the ears of the grain and actually rub it in their hands and rub the chaff off of it and eat it right there, right out of the field. And there was a law in the Old Testament back in Leviticus chapter 23, Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 14, in which they were authorized by the law of Moses to go to any field that they wanted to and help themselves to the grain in that field, even if they didn't own it. And now, particularly, it was meant for the poor people. It was not meant to be abused. But if you were a poor person, you could go down to your neighbor's field, and you could not carry any grain away. That was kind of like the unspoken law. You didn't take your sickle down there and harvest his grain for him and take that home. But you could go to his field and help yourself. And you could eat of his grain, and the farmer would look at you and not even bat an eyelash, because that was a very customary thing. And that's why Jesus and the disciples were walking along, and they stopped and they ate at fields. Now, they weren't stealing anything. In fact, the Pharisees did not rebuke them for that. If they would have been stealing, you know that the Pharisees would have jumped on that. They didn't. They jumped on the fact that Jesus was working on the Sabbath day. Look at that work they're doing, rubbing off the chaff on that grain on the Sabbath day. And the Lord forbid that type of evil deeds. See, that type of mentality is what they had. And you can read about that in Leviticus chapter 6 and verse 1. Leviticus chapter 6 and verse 1. They'd also take the grain that was not fully ripened, and they would parch it. They would fry it in a frying pan, and they would eat that as well, even though it was not fully ripe. So kind of like roasted grain. Now, the different types of grain that they ate, barley was customary, especially amongst the poor. Barley was cultivated in Palestine. Normally, the barley was fed to the cattle and the horses, but the poor Hebrews did use it for their food as well. They were so poor that they were eating barley. Now, the Bible does talk about corn. However, the corn that they had was actually a wheat, probably referring to wheat. Normally, the corn like what we think of today did not grow in that hemisphere. Corn was probably limited to the western hemisphere, not the eastern hemisphere. So they probably didn't have like corn on the cob. When it talks about they ate corn, corn is probably just referring to the fact that they're eating wheat. So the other crop that they had would be wheat, and that was the most widely used of all the grains amongst the Hebrews. It was a real staple of their diet. Now, another food is bread. In fact, that is the principal food in the Orient. About 3/4 of the people in the Orient live almost entirely, at least during that time, on bread. In fact, they ate bread every single day. And that was all they had sometimes. Maybe bread and some milk to drink or something. And that's about it. And it, of course, was either bread made from wheat or barley. In fact, they ate it so much that the term eating bread is synonymous with eating a meal. When the Bible talks about, and they broke bread and they did eat, that's really talking about they ate a meal, see? Pretty much synonymous. Now, there's a real sacredness that the Oriental attaches to bread, almost a sacred mystical meaning to bread. And in fact, they have such a reverence for bread that if they're breaking it right before the meal, and let's say a guest would enter into the room, they wouldn't even arise and salute the guest because they're breaking bread right now. It was a real holy event. Now, you know from the Oriental philosophy and mentality, they're very hospitable. And so this was a real priority to break the bread, a real sacred time. And they almost had a religious idea about the bread. Everything about the bread, from sowing the grain to baking the loaves, was done in the name of God and done with much prayer. There's also a universal Eastern custom of breaking bread and not cutting it with a knife. They do not believe in cutting bread with a knife, at least during the time of Jesus. That would symbolize cutting off life itself. So they didn't cut the bread with a knife, but rather they broke it with their hands. And that's, of course, why the term breaking bread occurs always in the Bible. Now, the form of loaves that they had for the bread, they had actually a couple of different types of loaves. They had like small little loaves that resemble bread biscuits, like what we might have today. Or they also had a much larger round loaf that you might go down to the marketplace, and they've got them stacked up down there, and you could go down to the marketplace and buy your bread, and maybe it's only a day or two old. They also had loaves that were flat loaves, kind of like the Norwegian lefse. You know what lefse is if you're Norsky? You have lefse. Lefse is I don't think there's any leaven in it. It's just real thin bread that's almost as thin as paper. And they had that type of bread as well. And that bread was used for their meals in the place of a knife or a fork or a spoon. They did not use silverware during that time. They ate with their fingers. And they would take their bread, this flat bread, and they would fold it up, and they'd dip it in their food and use that for a spoon. And they'd also just eat with their fingers. As far as baking bread, this was done in an interesting fashion. They had a couple of different ways to bake their bread, just depending on how advanced they were and how modernized they were. One real typical way was a sand oven, where they scooped out of the sand a little hole, as it were, and they built a hot fire there on the sand. And then after the fire had been burnt for a while, they would remove the fire, and they would take the dough and spread it out real thin and lay it right on the sand and bake it right there on the hot ground. Now, I've never liked sand in my food, backpacking or anything. If I crunch into dirt or something, that ruins my meal for me right there. sure how they got rid of the sand, if they peeled off a layer of the bread or what they did, but I would assume that there'd be a little bit of dirt in the bread, but maybe they just shrugged their shoulders and felt like not that big of a thing. There's another oven that they had, a little bit more advanced, an earth oven. And that's a hole in the earth. And so they dig this hole in the earth, or they had the hole maybe built outside their house. And what they do, they build a fire inside this hole. And they put rocks inside this hole, and they'd heat these rocks up real hot, and then they would remove the fire, and they'd spread the dough on the hot rocks. And in fact, I've got a slide of this, and the bread is right there on the hot rocks, and it's baking. And they were pretty good at baking it right there on the hot rocks. Or if you were traveling, they did have a portable oven, and it was a clay oven. And they could build a fire inside this clay oven, and they'd get the clay oven real hot, and they'd take the dough, and they would put it right on the side of the oven. And it sticks right there on the side of the oven, that hot clay oven, and it will actually bake on the side of that hot clay oven. So it just kind of, you know, depends on how advanced you were and how good you were at this. They also had a public oven very often in the middle of the little village, and this was a very large oven. And they didn't have a lot of wood in Palestine. Very hard to find wood. So they shared the oven, and you could go down to the public oven, which was much larger in size, and you could bake your bread there as well. They also, of course, ate vegetables. That was an everyday fare for the Israelites. Many of them had their own vegetable gardens. Some of the prominent foods that the Bible talks about, things like beans and lentils, which are very similar to our modern garden peas. Cucumbers were eaten, onions and garlics were eaten, and then a product called leeks. Maybe some of you know what a leek is. It's kind of like a glorified onion, really, is what it looks like. But a leek, and then gourds were eaten as well, and I'm not sure what type of gourds, probably something like squash. And then dairy products were very common. The Bible talks about Palestine as being a land flowing with milk and honey. Incidentally, I'm sure they had many other vegetables as well. I'm mentioning only the ones that are talked about in the Bible. But the Hebrews drank all kinds of milk. They drank the milk of cows. They drank the milk of sheep. They drank the milk of goats. And also the milk of camels. And they got quite a bit of milk out of a camel. A camel's a big animal. So they would milk their camels and their cows and their sheep and their goats. And they could do several different things with the milk. They could drink it fresh, obviously, or they could make a product that they called leaven. And that's kind of like our modern yogurt, minus all the sugar in it. So it was a little bit sour. Leaven, L-E-B-E-N, which was actually like our sour milk curds. So they made leaven out of the milk, or they made things like butter out of the milk, too, obviously. And butter was made. They also made cheese out of sour milk, which was very convenient. Cheese keeps a little bit longer than anything else and also is convenient for traveling. They had a real interesting churn that they used. You know what a churn is. That's where you put the milk in it, and often you have like something to stir the milk up in or churn the milk so it will turn into something like butter. They had what was called a goatskin churn, and they would take the skin of the goat, they would sew it all up, they would fill it with milk, and they would hang it from a tripod, three different sticks like this that were put together, and that goatskin would be hanging right from that tripod, and they would tie a rope to the neck on that goatskin, and they'd have like the youngest girl of the family, she'd stand out there and just pull the rope like this, and that goatskin would swing back and forth like this for maybe an hour or whatever it took, and that would mix up the milk and that would form the butter. And they'd come back out and they'd take the butter out of the goatskin and, of course, consume it. And then meat, they also ate meat, although meat was not eaten except on rare and special occasions. So obviously meat doesn't keep unless it's dried out. And meat is very costly, at least it was during that time. Normally, they ate bread and grains and fruits, that type of food. But on these special occasions when maybe a stranger came and visited them or a guest came to them or maybe during a holy day or a special festivity, they also ate meat. Now, there are different types of meat that they ate. All of them were kosher, I understand. But calf was one type of food, and that was pretty much the choicest of all meats. That was relegated to the very highest event of the year, maybe a real festive occasion. For example, the prodigal son, when he came back home again, the father killed the fatted calf. Kids were eaten. Now, I don't mean child kids, but young goats were eaten. That was a little bit inferior type food. It was more common meat. It was cheaper. and it was more easily obtained, is what I'm saying, by those who were a little bit poor. They also ate birds, fowls like partridge and quail and geese and pigeons. They ate pigeons as well. And then fish. Fish was a very, how do you know? You've never tried it. Probably. You've never eaten pigeon. It might be pretty good. Probably something like a little quail, yes. Pigeons? Well, I'm sure that they would have never eaten them if they were unclean, because they were really scrupulous about their dietary laws. So evidently, they're really not a bird of prey. Most of the unclean birds are birds of prey that prey on dead carrion, or I don't think pigeons really eat that. You're probably used to seeing them hop around downtown Seattle or something in the gutter. Right? And in the parks and everything. But I don't think pigeons would eat something like a dead mouse. I don't know, maybe they would, but I think that they're more or less looking for, like, seeds and French fries that people lay and breadcrumbs. And they will. I've seen them eat. I've fed them myself French fries. They love them. They love them. They also even ate sparrows. Can you believe it? They sold sparrows in the marketplace. And in fact, often the sparrows were so cheap, the merchant would actually throw in an extra sparrow. But they would go down to the marketplace, and often they were already on the skewer right there for the Israelites to roast, and there'd be maybe half a dozen. It'd take that many, you know, for a sparrow. Sparrow's awfully little, and I don't even see how you could get a single bite out of it. I don't know if they ate the intestines and everything else, but somehow they would even eat sparrows, those who were a little bit more poor. And then also, of course, they ate sheep, that is lamb, and especially prized amongst the sheep, not just the meat, not just the mutton, but the tail. They loved the tails, and there was a very special type of sheep that they had in Palestine. They were called fat-tailed sheep, and the tails would get very large in size. Sometimes the tails would weigh as much as 15 pounds, a single tail. In fact, it gets so bad, they actually had little carts that they put behind the sheep to hold their tails up. Right. It's a real special breed of sheep, and these... No, I'm not. I didn't believe it either at first, and then I read it in a couple of different sources. And in fact, if I remember right, I think I remember seeing a sketch or a picture of it. And they had like a little wheel contraption holding the tail up, and they would just walk across the Palestinian hills. Probably couldn't run very fast, but that would hold their tail up. And that was a real delicacy, that tail. Of course, every Passover, they would have to slay a lamb and eat that as well. So lambs were a real big commodity there for them. Also honey. They also ate honey. They had a sweet tooth just like you and I do. And Palestine, again, was a land flowing with milk and honey. And there were two sources for their honey, obviously. They cultivated some bees, but also there were wild bees. And they would take the honey from the wild bees as well. And they could find wild bee honey in either cavities of trees or even in the holes of the rocks over in Palestine. There are certain types of rocks where the bees will put their honey and store their honey in there, and they'll cover those holes with wax. And the Bible talks about sucking honey out of the rocks. That's true, literal. They will really do that. They will suck honey out of the rocks. In fact, there's a song, an old Pentecostal song, that talks about sucking honey out of the rocks. And I used to hear that, and I used to think, what's that talking about anyway, sucking honey out of the rocks? But it's considered a real delicacy, and they really did that. Of course, they loved fruits. Fruits were very common in Palestine, real favorite. The primary fruits are as follows. Of course, grapes. They had a lot of vineyards. Vineyards covered most of Palestine. They could eat fresh, ripe grapes from September to October. And then, other than that, they'd have to make raisins out of them to keep them throughout the year. But grapes and raisins were very common. Of course, the raisins were made out of grapes that were dried in bunches. Pomegranates. I've never had a pomegranate. I've seen them in stores. It's a beautiful rose-red fruit with many seeds inside of it. Don't ask me what it tastes like. I'm not sure, but I'm told by authorities it's very tasty and juicy. And then melons, not sure what type. I've read that they did have things like, I think, watermelons and cantaloupes. Very tasty and juicy. And also, there's a product in the Bible called the apple, but actually, that translates a Hebrew word which means a citron. C-I-T-R-O-N, a citron, which was a little bit different than our apple. It was a yellow gold fragrant fruit. and that was supposed to be very tasty as well. Citron, yellow gold fruit. Figs were very common. They grew throughout Palestine. They planted fig trees everywhere. It was very common to have them even for a shade tree, and they would often be growing singly or in small groups like little orchards. And often, if it was just growing somewhere alongside the road, you could help yourself to figs. Or, of course, if it was on your property, you could harvest them. Certain types of fig trees had two different harvests, one more in the springtime, and then a second harvest that came on the fruit tree a little bit later on, more towards the fall time. Olives were very customary, and olive oil. The olive tree represents and almost resembles an apple tree, will bear fruit even when it's very old. The olives are basically harvested by shaking the tree or beating the olives off with sticks. And they would go to the tree and hit the tree with sticks and beat the olives off. God told them to always be sure that they leave some olives on the tree for the poor. And after they were done harvesting the olive trees, then the poor could come and take any olives that were left on the tree. And God made sure that there was provision made for the poor through the harvest of the grain and also through the olive trees. Some of the fruit was eaten, but most of the olive crop was taken, and it was pressed or squeezed, and the olive oil was taken from it, and it was used for a number of different things. They used it for cooking. They used it for food. They used it for anointing themselves with. It was kind of like a beauty cream and a head cream. They would anoint their hair with it. And also it was used for burning in their lamps. It also burned very well. And then one final crop would be the date palm, and dates primarily grew along the shore of the Mediterranean Ocean and also in the Jordan River Valley down by the Jordan River. And also along the fringes of the desert wherever there was a moist spot or an oasis, and they would take the dates and they would either eat the fruit raw or they would dry and cake them and preserve them for winter use. So they had actually a fair amount of variety in their diet and was not a lot different than what we basically eat today, although I think we have a lot more junk food today. And we have things like Fritos and Cheetos and Snickers and things like that. And they probably were a lot better off than we are today, I would assume. Now let's talk about some of the customs at mealtime. What would happen if you were actually going to eat food during that time? Well, obviously one of the first things that you'd have to do is wash your hands before eating. They did not eat with unwashed hands. And they had a very peculiar custom, a very peculiar way of washing their hands. They never would fill a basin full of water and just plunge their hands into it and wash it like that. To them, that would be a real disgrace, because what you're doing, you're washing your hands in dirty water. You're washing the dirt off your hands, and the dirt is in the water, so really you're putting your hands in dirty water. So they did it differently. They'd often have a servant pour water over your hands, and you'd hold your hands out, and the servant would pour water over your hands. And then there was a basin that was put under your hands, and it had a concave cover on it with holes drilled in it. And the water would go into this concave cover into the basin out of your sight. They did not want you looking at the dirty water. So it would go inside the basin, and that's how your hands were pretty much washed. And, of course, that was real necessary, real vital, because they did not use knives or forks or spoons. They ate with their fingers, and they ate out of common bowls. And it's bad enough to eat, you know, your food if your hands are dirty. But if you're eating out of the same bowl as someone else and their hands are dirty, you know how you do that. You don't want to eat with them. As far as the position that they... Oh, one more point. The Pharisees did ostracize and condemn Jesus because he ate with unwashed hands. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus had dirt under his fingernails and his hands were covered with dirt and Jesus didn't wash his hands. What it means is that Jesus didn't follow the ceremony that the Pharisees had for washing their hands. They had a real, real rigid ceremony. For example, the container that held the water, it had to be the size of two eggshells. And it was a certain size. No other containers were allowed, thank you. And that was the only size that they used. And you had to pour the water, and it had to cover the entire hand from the wrist down. And it was very carefully done. And if any portion was missed, it had to be done over again. And so it often took a lot of time for them to wash their hands, and they'd have to keep dipping the water out of this little eggshell container type thing. And what it means is that Jesus wasn't really too concerned about how they did it. He washed his hands in a customary Palestinian way, but he did not follow their legalistic custom. And so they're saying, you're not eating with washed hands. And that doesn't mean he ate with dirty hands. It just simply means he didn't follow their ceremony. Now, the position that they ate in, normally they sat on the floor. Normally they did not have chairs that they sat in. They either sat with their legs underneath them in what we call Indian fashion, or they kneeled on their knees. And as far as the use of a table and chairs and dishes, etc., they did not have a table normally that they ate at. Normally their table was a skin mat just spread out on the floor. And in fact, the Hebrew word shulchan, which is the Hebrew word for table, actually means a skin or leather mat that is spread on the ground. That's what it really means. So when the Bible talks about they sat down at the table or whatever, that's kind of translated in our understanding, but normally they would just sit down on the floor. And in fact, David made an interesting statement, and you can only understand it from the Oriental viewpoint. David said back in Psalm 69 and verse 22, David said, "Let their table become a snare before them." And he's talking about the wicked. What's he saying, that you're somehow going to trip on the leg of your table? No, he's really talking about that leather mat. Let that get tangled in your feet and may the wicked stumble. That's what he's really talking about. As far as chairs, they normally didn't use chairs. They didn't sit down on them. They normally squatted on the floor around either that mat or maybe possibly a low table. If you were a member of royalty, though, like in a palace, there they might have a table that you sat at on a chair. We know that Joseph and his brethren sat down at a table and chairs in the land of Egypt. From Genesis chapter 43 and verse 33, Genesis 43 and verse 33, and David also sat down at Saul's table in 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 5. 1 Samuel chapter 20 verse 5. As far as dishes, only the dishes that had the food in them were the dishes eaten out of. In other words, you didn't get your separate plate. They would bring the food out, and the food was in certain bowls, and everyone dipped their hands into the same bowl. And so you were all eating out of the same plates. That's why they made it very certain that your hands were clean. And that's why Jesus, when Peter asked Jesus and John asked Jesus, "Who is going to betray you?" And the disciples didn't know, and Jesus said, "The one that dips his hand with me in the dish." And they still didn't know who the betrayer was, because there were several people dipping their hands in the dish with Jesus, see. And that would not have been a clear indication of them. Now, they did say grace before their meals. And if there was a man of God there in their midst or a priest, often he was asked to say grace. But they did say grace before their meals. And then after they were done with their meals, it was also customary to say a second prayer after, thanking God for their food. Now also, like I mentioned, they did not use their hands, or I should say they did not use knives, forks, and spoons. They did use their hands. There's an Arab saying that goes like this: what does a man want of a spoon when God has given him so many fingers? So it's kind of strange that we eat with spoons and a knife and a fork. They just dig right in there with their hands. They'll take the sheets of bread and they'll fold them up and they'll use that in the place of silverware. And then they'll often dip their fingers right in the food itself. Let's talk about special suppers and banquets for a few minutes here. As far as banquet invitations, let's say that you're going to have a banquet and you want to invite people to come to your house. And incidentally, they celebrated on a number of occasions. They were really a joyful people. It was a hard life. They worked hard. And so therefore, they made a lot out of their meals, and they like to socialize. They're very social people. And they actually had feasts on a lot of different occasions, like the holy days, maybe the Passover, Pentecost, or the Sabbath day was a day in which they would eat together, or the Feast of the New Moon, or the Year of Jubilee, or anything like that, the Feast of Purim, or Dedication, Hanukkah. But also they'd have feasts for like marriages, or on birthdays. A birthday was a major occasion. Or on sheep shearing occasions, in which they would harvest the wool off the sheep, or anything like that, they would have a major banquet. Now, as far as an invitation, they would often send out a double invitation. You were sent the first invitation, and you were invited to come, and so that was one invitation. And then as the appointed time for the feast drew near, then a servant would be sent out, and the servant would tell you when the feast was actually ready. So they didn't go like by time like what we go by. But the way it worked is that you knew basically what day the banquet was going to be on, and you just pretty much waited in your own home, and a servant would come, knock on your door, and tell you that the feast is now ready, and then you'd walk over to where the feast was. And you can see that in Matthew chapter 22, verses 2 through 3, Matthew chapter 22, 2 through 3, and Luke 14, verses 16 through 17. Luke 14, 16 through 17. Now, a real important feature as far as inviting people to come to your house, you'd have to compel them to come, because it was customary to actually reject the invitation. That was a real major feature, in fact, a very important feature of Oriental hospitality. The first time they invited you, you always said no, always, always. You'd always say, no, can't come. And they'd compel you to come. They would urge you. They'd say, the feast will not be the same without you. You must come. Today you will come. No, I'm sorry, I cannot come. And of course, in their heart, the whole time they're saying, of course I'm going to come. I want to come. But their mouth is saying, no, I will not come. And so therefore, the servant or the host is urging them and compelling them to come. And you've got to be compelled to accept the invitation and to come to the feast. And you can read about that in Luke chapter 14 and verse 23. Luke 14, verse 23. And actually, what it means is to compel by threat in that verse. They made it very clear that you were going to come, or they were going to break your neck, or something like that. And then you would say you would come. Now, I'm not sure they used that terminology. But you'd never say yes right off the bat. That would have offended them. You always said no. But what it made you feel like, it made it feel like you were really needed. It made it feel like, well, this thing just isn't going to fly if you don't come. It's not going to come out really good. And so you would, of course, say no. And then they would prevail upon you. And you can read about two other passages here. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 15, it talks about Lydia. Luke chapter 16, verse 15. And there she had to constrain Paul and his companions to accept her hospitality. And the New American Standard has the idea she prevailed upon them. See? And they were saying no, and she prevailed upon them. Finally, Luke chapter 7, verse 36.
Is that
Acts 16? Yes, Acts 16. What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. It is Acts chapter 16, verse 15. I'm sorry. Thank you, brother. Acts chapter 16 and verse 15, and then Luke chapter 7, verse 36. So Acts 16, 15, and then Luke 7, 36. Yes? Yes. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I know I ate at Kamal's house from Egypt. He's that way. I mean, they really prevail upon you. In fact, they put the food on your plate, you know, and then they put the plate on front of you, and it's heat. And it's just amazing. I mean, when we were at their house, they really go all out. They are the most hospitable people I've ever met. I mean, it's just amazing. They're really hospitable like that. And it just flows out of their heart. It's their personality. And there's no way that you'd say no. Because they just, you know, there's more food on your plate, and you eat, and you talk, and so forth, and that's the way they do it. So that's pretty interesting. Yes?
Back there when you were talking about food and you did the scriptures, you said the second one was Leviticus 1. I'm sure you meant Luke 6.
Did I? Okay. Okay, yes, I probably did say that one wrong too then. Okay, well, let me correct that. Obviously, you mean Peter's not in the book of Leviticus? I'm sure that you're wrong on that, sister. I'm sure he is, isn't he? Well, I better correct my notes for survey of the Bible. Leviticus is in the New Testament, isn't it? See, where is that? Where did I say that? I'm sure I did. What happens, my mind thinks one thing, but my mouth will say something else. So, at the very beginning. Yes, it's Luke 6:1. Yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Just keep me in line. Don't let me get out of line. Okay.
Hi.
Okay.
I mean, it's almost done.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, you handed
it. I should have started with this. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I got so bad last night. I got all the reference books, and I just gave a jump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. Praise the Lord. That's good. How are things down in Oregon?